This is Audible.
Amazon Studios, together with Topic Studios, presents the audiobook of the Declassified Executive Summary of the U.S. Senate's Committee Study of the Central Intelligence Agency's Detention and Interrogation Program, also known as the Senate Torture Report. This audio version of the Senate Torture Report includes select footnotes, as well as notations to material that currently remains redacted and classified by the U.S. government. This audiobook is read by actors from the Report movie, with an introduction by Daniel J. Jones, the Senate's lead investigator, and the credits read by me, the film's director, Scott Z. Burns.
Introduction, Daniel J. Jones. The Committee Study of the Central Intelligence Agency's Detention and Interrogation Program is a congressional report by the United States Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, SSCI. An executive summary of the report was published on December 9, 2014. While the investigation officially began on March 5, 2009, it grew out of an earlier review of actions that took place on November 9, 2005, when two senior CI officers from the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, ordered the destruction of more than 90 videotapes depicting individuals being subjected to what the CIA called enhanced interrogation techniques. The term was a euphemism for interrogation tactics that the U.S. government has long considered to be torture and a violation of U.S. and international law. The techniques were derived from the U.S. military's Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape training program, which exposes U.S. special forces to interrogation techniques that have been used by foreign regimes to extract false confessions. The two CIA officers identified as the most culpable for the destruction of the videotapes did so knowing that their superiors at the CIA, the White House, and the U.S. Office of Director of National Intelligence wanted the videotapes preserved. The officers were never held accountable for their actions. One retired from the CIA in good standing, wrote a book about his CIA service, and continues to defend the CIA's interrogation tactics. The other became director of the CIA in 2008. As this Senate report details, the destruction of the CIA videotapes occurred a day after the Senate considered a wide-ranging congressional investigation into the treatment of detainees in U.S. government custody. That vote, like numerous other efforts to conduct congressional oversight of the executive branch at the time, failed. As such, much of what is known about the CIA's detention interrogation program prior to the committee's work was uncovered and published by investigative journalists. For example, news of the destruction of the videotapes came to light via an investigative report published by the New York Times on December 6, 2007, more than 2 years after the tapes' destruction. Within weeks of the Times report, the chairs of the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States, also known as the 9/11 Commission, accused the CIA of obstructing their investigation by withholding and destroying the tapes. The Bush administration's Department of Justice launched a criminal probe of the CIA's actions, and Senator Jay Rockefeller, then chairman of the SSCI, summoned CIA Director Michael Hayden to the committee to gather more information. While the CIA director at the time of the videotapes' destruction in 2005, Porter Goss, had instructed that the videotapes be preserved, Hayden, who became director in May 2006, defended their destruction and testified that the CIA officers who ordered the tapes be destroyed did not obstruct justice or destroy evidence, because there were CIA operational cables that Hayden asserted were a, quote, more than adequate representation of what was on the tapes, end quote. Hayden further asserted that if the committee wanted to review those records, it could. 6 months later, the CIA made available heavily redacted operational cables that included details on the early interrogations of two CIA detainees. Thus began the first component of the Senate's long journey to investigate and uncover the facts of the CIA's post-9/11 detention and interrogation program. Committee Chairman Rockefeller directed a counsel on the committee, former CIA lawyer Alyssa Starzak, and me, a former Federal Bureau of Investigation analyst, to review the CIA cables and draft a classified report on the content of the cables. The resulting tapes investigation report described the treatment of two individuals in CIA custody, Abu Zubaydah and Abd al-Rashim al-Nashiri. By the time the tapes investigation was completed and its findings presented to the SSCI on February 11, 2009, Senator Feinstein had become chair of the committee. She described the details in the staff report as chilling. Some of the early information uncovered during the tapes investigation can be found in this redacted executive summary, including Abu Zubaydah, the first detainee in the CIA's detention and interrogation program, was captured in March 2002 and questioned by FBI and CIA personnel until June 18, 2002, when the CIA placed Abu Zubaydah in isolation for 47 days. The FBI never returned to the detention site. During this 47-day period, the CIA sought to obtain policy and legal approval to use its enhanced interrogation techniques against Zubaydah. When the CIA re-engaged with Zubaydah on August 4, 2002, he was immediately subjected to the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques in, quote, varying combination 24 hours a day, end quote, for 20 days. The techniques continued sporadically for another 10 days. Among other measures, Zubaydah spent 11 days and 2 hours in a coffin-shaped box, 29 hours in a smaller box, was deprived of sleep, and subjected to the waterboard, quote, 2 to 4 times a day, end quote. The first waterboarding of Zubaydah occurred just 6 hours and 10 minutes after his questioning resumed on August 4, 2002. The use of the waterboard against Abu Zubaydah resulted in, quote, involuntary leg, chest, and arm spasms, end quote. CIA personnel described Zubaydah as, quote, hysterical, end quote, and, quote, distressed to a level that he was unable to effectively communicate, end quote. CIA personnel at the detention site believed that Abu Zubaydah was not withholding information and that they had reached the legal limit in their application of the techniques. When the detention site personnel requested to end the use of the techniques against Zubaydah, CIA headquarters instructed them to continue. After CIA personnel at the detention site ceased using the techniques against Zubaydah, they judged them to be effective, not because the techniques resulted in new information, but because it confirmed that Zubaydah did not possess the intelligence that CIA headquarters believed him to have, information on current terrorist plotting, or operatives in the United States. Based on the findings of the tapes investigation, on March 5, 2009, the committee approved a far more expansive investigation of the entire CIA detention interrogation program by a vote of 14 to 1. Several months later, the CIA began providing records requested by the committee, a production phase that lasted more than 3 years, eventually ending in July 2012 with over 6.3 million pages of highly classified material, including operational cables, reports, memoranda, emails, and intelligence products. The materials also included interviews of key CIA personnel who participated in the program that were conducted by the CIA's Office of the Inspector General and other CIA entities while the program was still active. On April 3, 2014, by a vote of 11 to 3, the committee agreed to send the executive summary to the president for declassification. It took until December 9, 2014, to come to an agreement with the White House on alterations and redactions for the publicly released executive summary, as well as for a final and complete report to become an official record of the U.S. Senate. That report, Senate Report 113-288, is believed to be the largest in U.S. Senate history. The classified report is more than 6,700 pages and includes nearly 38,000 footnotes. The full classified report is divided into 3 volumes. Volume 1, entitled History and Operation of the CIA's Detention and Interrogation Program, is presented chronologically and describes the establishment, development, and evolution of the CIA's detention and interrogation program from the program's authorization on September 17, 2001, to its official end on January 22, 2009. There is an addendum to this volume entitled CIA Clandestine Detention Sites and the Arrangements Made with Foreign Entities in Relation to the CIA's Detention and Interrogation Program. In total, Volume 1 is 1,539 pages. Volume 2, entitled Intelligence Acquired and CIA Representations on the Effectiveness of the CIA's Enhanced Interrogation Techniques, focuses on the CIA's effectiveness claims relating to its enhanced interrogation techniques and provides details on how the CIA misrepresented the program to the White House, the Department of Justice, the Congress, and the media. In total, Volume 2 is 1,858 pages. Volume 3, entitled Detention and Interrogation of CIA Detainees, provides details on the detention and interrogation of the 119 known CIA detainees. This volume documents the management failures, conditions of confinement, lack of appropriate CIA headquarters oversight, and other shortcomings of the program. In total, Volume 3 is 2,855 pages. The executive summary of the Senate report, printed here with redactions, includes 20 findings and conclusions, supporting three central themes. 1. The CIA's interrogation tactics were ineffective at gaining reliable intelligence and resulted in detainees providing false statements. 2. The CIA repeatedly provided inaccurate and misleading information about the program to the White House, the Department of Justice, the Congress, and the public, including inaccurate information on the effectiveness of its enhanced interrogation techniques, inaccurate details on the treatment of detainees and their conditions of confinement, and inaccurate information about the operation and management of the program. 3. The CIA failed to properly manage the program. It did not implement appropriate safeguards, provide adequate oversight, or hold CIA employees accountable for wrongdoing. This redacted executive summary of the Senate report includes 2,725 footnotes, which provide additional context, sourcing information, and details on the CIA's June 2013 response to the report. The footnotes are essential for understanding the full scope of the committee's work and highlight key details not discussed in the body of the report. For example, footnote number 245 provides evidence that the waterboard was used against more detainees than the CIA has previously acknowledged. Through the publication of this report in December of 2014, the CIA has maintained that only three CIA detainees were subjected to the waterboard. Footnote 245 casts doubt on that assertion and reveals that the full committee study includes a photograph of a waterboard at a CIA detention facility where there are no records of waterboarding taking place. As described in the footnote, the waterboard device in the photograph is surrounded by buckets, quote, with a bottle of unknown pink solution filled two-thirds of the way to the top and a watering can resting on the wooden beams of the waterboard, end quote. The footnote states that, quote, in meetings between the committee staff and the CIA in the summer of 2013, the CIA was unable to explain the details of the photograph to include the buckets, solution, and watering can, as well as the waterboard's presence at the detention site, end quote. Footnote 584 discusses the application of two unapproved interrogation techniques used against CIA detainees, rectal feeding and rectal rehydration. CIA detainees were subjected to the techniques without evidence of medical need, and a CIA medical officer wrote in March 2003 that rectal rehydration helped, quote, clear a person's head, unquote, during an interrogation. The CIA's June 2013 response defended the use of rectal rehydration as, quote, a well-acknowledged medical technique, end quote. The CIA's June 2013 response was silent on the use of rectal feeding. Footnote 727 describes interviews with CIA officials in September 2003 regarding the possibility that details of the CIA's detention and interrogation program could one day become public. CIA Deputy Director of Operations James Pavitt described that scenario as, quote, the CIA's worst nightmare, end quote, while George Tenet, the director, stated that, quote, if the general public were to find out about this program, many would believe we are torturers, end quote. Footnote 2527 elaborates on the CIA's efforts to hide the existence of the videotapes from the committee and other policymakers, including senior figures in the White House. The footnote details the CIA's general counsel's response to a June 2003 inquiry from Vice President Dick Cheney's counsel, David Addington. In an email to CIA Office of General Counsel colleagues providing details on the conversation, the CIA General Counsel described how he provided an incomplete answer to Addington, writing, quote, David Addington asked me if we're taping interrogations and said that he had heard there were tapes of the Zubeda interrogations, end quote. The CIA's General Counsel avoided fully answering the question, writing to his colleagues that he simply told Addington, quote, that tapes were not being made, end quote. Congressional oversight reports begin and end with elected officials carrying out their constitutional responsibilities. Quite simply, this important work would not have been completed without the direction and resolve of key U.S. senators, including then-Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Senator John McCain, and the chairs of the committee during my tenure, Senators Dianne Feinstein and Jay Rockefeller. The committee's staff director during the investigation, David Granis, ably managed the political aspects of this review, allowing our investigative team to focus on the facts. That team included Evan Gottesman, Alyssa Starzak, and Chad Tanner, each of whom played substantial roles in the research and drafting of the report. Other Senate staff provided guidance, edits, and additions, all of which strengthened this oversight effort. I hope the redacted executive summary printed here reminds the public of the importance of congressional oversight, especially of intelligence programs hidden from public view, and proves useful in conducting future oversight investigations. Daniel J. Jones, Chief Investigator, United States Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, 2007 to 2016.
Forward. On April 3, 2014, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence voted to send the findings and conclusions of the executive summary of its final study on the CIA's detention and interrogation program to the President for declassification and subsequent public release. This action marked the culmination of a monumental effort that officially began with the committee's decision to initiate the study in March 2009. But which had its roots in an investigation into the CIA's destruction of videotapes of CIA detainee interrogations that began in December 2007. The full committee study, which totals more than 6,700 pages, remains classified, but is now an official Senate report. The full report has been provided to the White House, the CIA, the Department of Justice, the Department of Defense, the Department of State, and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence in hopes that it will prevent future coercive interrogation practices and inform the management of other covert action programs. As the chairman of the committee since 2009, I write to offer some additional views, context, and history. I began my service on the Senate Intelligence Committee in January 2001. I remember a testimony that summer from George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, that warned of a possible major terrorist event against the United States, but without specifics on the time, location, or method of attack. On September 11, 2001, the world learned the answers to those questions that had consumed the CIA and other parts of the U.S. intelligence community. For information on the events at the CIA prior to September 11, 2001, see the final report of the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States, 9/11 Commission, and Office of the Inspector General Report on Accountability with Respect to the 9/11 Attacks. I recall vividly watching the horror of that day, to include the television footage of innocent men and women jumping out of the World Trade Center towers to escape the fire. The images and the sounds as their bodies hit the pavement far below will remain with me for the rest of my life. It is against that backdrop, the largest attack against the American homeland in our history, that the events described in this report were undertaken. Nearly 13 years later, the executive summary and findings and conclusions of this report are being released. They are highly critical of the CIA's actions, and rightfully so. Reading them, it is easy to forget the context in which the program began. Not that the context should serve as an excuse, but rather as a warning for the future. It's worth remembering the pervasive fear in late 2001 and how immediate the threat felt. Just a week after the September 11 attacks, powdered anthrax was sent to various news organizations and to two U.S. senators. The American public was shocked by news of new terrorist plots and elevations of the color-coded threat level of the Homeland Security Advisory System. We expected further attacks against the nation. I have attempted throughout to remember the impact on the nation and to the CIA workforce from the attacks of September 11, 2001. I can understand the CIA's impulse to consider the use of every possible tool to gather intelligence and remove terrorists from the battlefield, and CIA was encouraged by political leaders and the public to do whatever it could to prevent another attack. It is worth repeating that covert action authorities approved by the President in September 2001 did not provide any authorization or contemplate coercive interrogations. The Intelligence Committee as well often pushes intelligence agencies to act quickly in response to threats and world events. Nevertheless, such pressure, fear, and expectation of further terrorist plots do not justify, temper, or excuse improper actions taken by individuals or organizations in the name of national security. The major lesson of this report is that regardless of the pressures of the need to act, the intelligence community's actions must always reflect who we are as a nation and adhere to our laws and standards. It is precisely at these times of national crisis that our government must be guided by the lessons of our history and subject decisions to internal and external review. Instead, CIA personnel, aided by two outside contractors, decided to initiate a program of indefinite secret detention and the use of brutal interrogation techniques in violation of U.S. law, treaty obligations, and our values. This committee study documents the abuses and countless mistakes made between late 2001 and early 2009. The executive summary of the study provides a significant amount of new information based on CIA and other documents to what has already been made public by the Bush and Obama administrations, as well as non-governmental organizations and the press. The committee's full study is more than 10 times the length of the executive summary and includes comprehensive and excruciating detail. The study describes the history of the CIA's detention and interrogation program from its inception to its termination, including a review of each of the 119 known individuals who were held in CIA custody. The full committee study also provides substantially more detail than what is included in the executive summary on the CIA's justification and defense of its interrogation program on the basis that it was necessary and critical to the disruption of specific terrorist plots and the capture of specific terrorists. While the executive summary provides sufficient detail to demonstrate the inaccuracies of these claims, the information in the full committee study is far more extensive. I chose not to seek declassification of the full committee study at this time. I believe that the executive summary includes enough information to adequately describe the CIA's detention and interrogation program, and the committee's findings and conclusions cover the entirety of the program. Seeking declassification of the more than 6,000-page report would have significantly delayed the release of the executive summary. Decisions will be made later on the declassification and release of the full 6,700-page study. In 2009, when this effort began, I stated in a press release co-authored with the vice chairman of the committee, Senator Kit Bond, that the purpose is to review the program and to shape detention and interrogation policies in the future. The review is now done. It's my sincere and deep hope that through the release of these findings and conclusions and executive summary, that U.S. policy will never again allow for secret, indefinite detention and the use of coercive interrogations. As the study describes, prior to the attacks of 2001, the CIA itself determined from its experience with coercive interrogations that such techniques do not produce intelligence, will probably result in fake answers, and had historically proven to be ineffective. Yet these conclusions were ignored. We cannot again allow history to be forgotten and grievous past mistakes to be repeated. President Obama signed Executive Order 13491 in January 2009 to prohibit the CIA from holding detainees other than on a short-term, transitory basis and to limit interrogation techniques to those included in the Army Field Manual. However, these limitations are not part of U.S. law and could be overturned by a future president with the stroke of a pen. They should be enshrined in legislation. Even so, existing U.S. law and treaty obligations should have prevented many of the abuses and mistakes made during this program. While the Office of Legal Counsel found otherwise between 2002 and 2007, it is my personal conclusion that under any common meaning of the term, CIA detainees were tortured. I also believe that the conditions of confinement and the use of authorized and unauthorized interrogation and conditioning techniques were cruel, inhuman, and degrading. I believe the evidence of this is overwhelming and incontrovertible. While the committee did not make specific recommendations, several emerged from the committee's review. The CIA, in its June 2013 response to the committee's study from December 2012, has also already made and begun to implement its own recommendations. I intend to work with Senate colleagues to produce recommendations and to solicit views from the readers of the committee study. I would like to take this opportunity to describe the process of this study. As noted previously, the committee approved the terms of reference for the study in March 2009 and began requesting information from the CIA and other federal departments. The committee, through its staff, had already reviewed in 2008 thousands of CIA cables describing the interrogations of the CIA detainees Abu Zubaydah and Abed al-Rahim al-Nashiri, whose interrogations were the subject of videotapes that were destroyed by the CIA in 2005. The 2008 review was complicated by the existence of a Department of Justice investigation opened by Attorney General Michael Mukasey into the destruction of the videotapes and expanded by Attorney General Holder in August 2009. In particular, CIA employees and contractors who would otherwise have been interviewed by the committee staff were under potential legal jeopardy, and therefore the CIA would not compel its workforce to appear before the committee. This constraint lasted until the committee's research and documentary review were completed and the committee study had largely been finalized. Furthermore, given the volume and internal nature of relevant CIA documents, the CIA insisted that the committee enter into an arrangement where our staff would review documents and conduct research at a CIA-leased facility, redacted, rather than at the committee's offices on Capitol Hill. From early 2009 to late 2012, a small group of committee staff reviewed the more than 6 million pages of CIA materials to include operational cables, intelligence reports, internal memoranda and emails, briefing materials, interview transcripts, contracts, and other records. Draft sections of the study were prepared and distributed to the full committee membership beginning in October 2011, and this process continued through to the committee's vote to approve the full committee study on December 13, 2012. The breadth of documentary material on which the study relied and which the committee study cites is unprecedented. While the committee did not interview CIA officials in the context of the committee study, it had access to and drew from the interviews of numerous CIA officials conducted by the CIA's Inspector General and the CIA Oral History Program on subjects that lie at the heart of the committee study, as well as past testimony to the committee. Following the December 2012 vote, the committee study was sent to the President and appropriate parts of the executive branch for comments by February 15, 2013. The CIA responded in late June 2013 with extensive comments on the findings and conclusions, based in part on the responses of CIA officials involved in the program. At my direction, the committee staff met with CIA representatives in order to fully understand the CIA's comments and then incorporated suggested edits or comments as appropriate. The committee study, including the now declassified executive summary and findings and conclusions, as updated, is now final and represents the official views of the committee. This and future administrations should use this study to guide future programs, correct past mistakes, increase oversight of CIA representations to policymakers, and ensure coercive interrogation practices are not used by our government again. Finally, I want to recognize the members of the staff who have endured years of long hours poring through the difficult details of one of the lowest points in our nation's history. they have produced the most significant and comprehensive oversight report in the committee's history, and perhaps in that of the U.S. Senate, and their contributions should be recognized and praised. Daniel Jones has managed and led the committee's review effort from its inception. Dan has devoted more than 6 years to this effort, has personally written thousands of its pages, and has been integrally involved in every study decision. Evan Gottesman, Chad Tanner, and Alyssa Starzak have also played integral roles in the committee study and have spent considerable years researching and drafting specific sections of the committee study. Other committee staff members have also assisted in the review and provided valuable contributions at the direction of our committee members. They include, among others, Jennifer Barrett, Nick Basciano, Michael Buchwald, Jim Catella, Eric Chapman, John Dickus, Lorenzo Goko, Andrew Grotto, Tressa Gwenov, Cleet Johnson, Michael Noblet, Michael Pevsner, Tommy Ross, Caroline Tess, and James Wolfe. The committee's staff director throughout the review, David Granis, has played a central role in assisting me and guiding the committee throughout this entire process. Without the expertise, patience, and work ethic of our able staff, our members would not have been able to complete this most important work. Dianne Feinstein, Chairman, Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Committee Study of the Central Intelligence Agency's Detention and Interrogation Program. Findings and Conclusions. Approved December 13, 2012. Updated for release April 3, 2014. Declassification revisions December 3, 2014.
The committee makes the following findings and conclusions. 1. The CIA's use of its enhanced interrogation techniques was not an effective means of acquiring intelligence or gaining cooperation from detainees. The committee finds, based on a review of CIA interrogation records, that the use of the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques was not an effective means of obtaining accurate information or gaining detainee cooperation. For example, according to CIA records, 7 of the 39 CIA detainees known to have been subjected to the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques produced no intelligence while in CIA custody. CIA detainees who were subjected to the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques were usually subjected to the techniques immediately after being rendered to CIA custody. Other detainees provided significant accurate intelligence prior to or without having been subjected to these techniques. While being subjected to the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques and afterwards, multiple CIA detainees fabricated information, resulting in faulty intelligence. Detainees provided fabricated information on critical intelligence issues, including the terrorist threats, which the CIA identified as its highest priorities. At numerous times throughout the CIA's detention and interrogation program, CIA personnel assessed that the most effective method for acquiring intelligence from detainees, including from detainees the CIA considered to be the most, quote, high value, unquote, was to confront the detainees with information already acquired by the intelligence community. CIA officers regularly called into question whether the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques were effective, assessing that the use of the techniques failed to elicit detainee cooperation or produce accurate intelligence.
2. The CIA's justification for the use of its enhanced interrogation techniques rested on inaccurate claims of their effectiveness. The CIA represented to the White House, the National Security Council, the Department of Justice, the CIA Office of Inspector General, the Congress, and the public that the best measure of effectiveness of the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques was examples of specific terrorist plots thwarted, and specific terrorists captured as a result of the use of the techniques. The CIA used these examples to claim that its enhanced interrogation techniques were not only effective, but also necessary to acquire otherwise unavailable actionable intelligence that saved lives. The committee reviewed 20 of the most frequent and prominent examples of purported counterterrorism successes that the CIA has attributed to the use of its enhanced interrogation techniques and found them to be wrong in fundamental respects. In some cases, there was no relationship between the cited counterterrorism success and any information provided by detainees during or after the use of the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques. In the remaining cases, the CIA inaccurately claimed that specific, otherwise unavailable information was acquired from a CIA detainee as a result of the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques, when in fact, the information was either 1. Corroborative of information already available to the CIA or other elements of the U.S. intelligence community from sources other than the CIA detainee, and was therefore not otherwise unavailable, or 2. Acquired from the CIA detainee prior to the use of the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques. The examples provided by the CIA included numerous factual inaccuracies. In providing the effectiveness examples to policymakers, the Department of Justice, and others, the CIA consistently omitted the significant amount of relevant intelligence obtained from sources other than CIA detainees who had been subjected to the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques, leaving the false impression the CIA was acquiring unique information from the use of the techniques. Some of the plots that the CIA claimed to have disrupted as a result of the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques were assessed by intelligence and law enforcement officials as being infeasible or ideas that were never operationalized.
3. The interrogations of CIA detainees were brutal and far worse than the CIA represented to policymakers and others. Beginning with the CIA's first detainee, Abu Zubaydah, and continuing with numerous others, the CIA applied its enhanced interrogation techniques with significant repetitions for days or weeks at a time. Interrogation techniques, such as slaps and wallings, slamming detainees against a wall, were used in combination, frequently concurrent with sleep deprivation and nudity. Records do not support CIA representations that the CIA initially used an open, non-threatening approach, or that interrogations began with the least coercive technique possible and escalated to more coercive techniques only as necessary. The waterboarding technique was physically harmful, inducing convulsions and vomiting. Abu Zubaydah, for example, became completely unresponsive, with bubbles rising through his open, full mouth. Internal CIA records describe the waterboarding of colleague Sheikh Mohammed as evolving into a series of near drownings. Sleep deprivation involved keeping detainees awake for up to 180 hours, usually standing or in stress positions, at times with their hands shackled above their heads. At least 5 detainees experienced disturbing hallucinations during prolonged sleep deprivation and, in at least 2 of those cases, the CIA nonetheless continued the sleep deprivation. Contrary to CIA representations to the Department of Justice, the CIA instructed personnel that the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah would take precedence over his medical care, resulting in the deterioration of a bullet wound Abu Zubaydah incurred during his capture. In at least 2 other cases, the CIA used its enhanced interrogation techniques despite warnings from CIA medical personnel that the techniques could exacerbate physical injuries. CIA medical personnel treated at least 1 detainee for swelling in order to allow the continued use of standing sleep deprivation. At least 5 CIA detainees were subjected to rectal rehydration or rectal feeding without documented medical necessity. The CIA placed detainees in ice water baths. The CIA led several detainees to believe they would never be allowed to leave CIA custody alive, suggesting to one detainee that he would only leave in a coffin-shaped box. One interrogator told another detainee that he would never go to court because, "We can never let the world know what I have done to you." CIA officers also threatened at least 3 detainees with harm to their families, to include threats to harm the children of a detainee, threats to sexually abuse the mother of a detainee, and a threat to cut a detainee's mother's throat.
4. The conditions of confinement for CIA detainees were harsher than the CIA had represented to policymakers and others. Conditions at CIA detention sites were poor and were especially bleak early in the program. CIA detainees at the Cobalt Detention Facility were kept in complete darkness and constantly shackled in isolated cells, with loud noise or music and only a bucket to use for human waste. Lack of heat at the facility likely contributed to the death of a detainee. The chief of interrogations described Cobalt as a dungeon. Another senior CIA officer stated that Cobalt was itself an enhanced interrogation technique. At times, the detainees at Cobalt were walked around naked or shackled with their hands above their heads for extended periods of time. Other times, the detainees at Cobalt were subjected to what was described as rough takedown, in which approximately 5 CIA officers would scream at a detainee, drag him outside of his cell, cut his clothes off, and secure him with Mylar tape. The detainee would then be hooded and dragged up and down a long corridor while being slapped and punched. Even after the conditions of confinement improved with the construction of new detention facilities, detainees were held in total isolation except when being interrogated or debriefed by CIA personnel. Throughout the program, multiple CIA detainees who were subjected to the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques and extended isolation exhibited psychological and behavioral issues, including hallucinations, paranoia, insomnia, and attempts at self-harm and self-mutilation. Multiple psychologists identified the lack of human contact experienced by detainees as a cause of psychiatric problems.
5. The CIA repeatedly provided inaccurate information to the Department of Justice, impeding a proper legal analysis of the CIA's detention and interrogation program. From 2002 to 2007, the Office of Legal Counsel, OLC, within the Department of Justice, relied on CIA representations regarding 1. The conditions of confinement for detainees, 2. The application of the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques, 3. The physical effects of the techniques on detainees, and 4. The effectiveness of the techniques. Those representations were inaccurate in material respects. The Department of Justice did not conduct independent analysis or verification of the information it received from the CIA. The department warned, however, that if the facts provided by the CIA were to change, its legal conclusions might not apply. When the CIA determined that information it had provided to the Department of Justice was incorrect, the CIA rarely informed the department. Prior to the initiation of the CIA's detention and interrogation program, and throughout the life of the program, the legal justifications for the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques relied on the CIA's claim that the techniques were necessary to save lives. In late 2001 and early 2002, senior attorneys at the CIA Office of General Counsel first examined the legal implications of using coercive interrogation techniques. CIA attorneys stated that a novel application of the necessity defense could be used to avoid prosecution of U.S. officials who tortured to obtain information that saved many lives. Having reviewed information provided by the CIA, the OLC included the necessity defense in its August 1, 2002 memorandum to the White House Counsel on Standards of Conduct for Interrogation. The OLC determined that, under current circumstances, necessity or self-defense may justify interrogation methods that might violate the criminal prohibition against torture. On the same day, a second OLC opinion approved, for the first time, the use of 10 specific coercive interrogation techniques against Abu Zubaydah, subsequently referred to as the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques. The OLC relied on inaccurate CIA representations about Abu Zubaydah's status in Al-Qaeda and the interrogation team's certainty that Abu Zubaydah was withholding information about planned terrorist attacks. The CIA's representations to the OLC about the techniques were also inconsistent with how the techniques would later be applied. In March 2005, the CIA submitted to the Department of Justice various examples of the effectiveness of the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques that were inaccurate. OLC memoranda signed on May 30, 2005, and July 20, 2007, relied on these representations, determining that the techniques were legal in part because they produced specific actionable intelligence and substantial quantities of otherwise unavailable intelligence that saved lives.
6. The CIA has actively avoided or impeded congressional oversight of the program. The CIA did not brief the leadership of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence on the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques until September 2002, after the techniques had been approved and used. The CIA did not respond to Chairman Bob Graham's request for additional information in 2002, noting in its own internal communications that he would be leaving the committee in January 2003. The CIA subsequently resisted efforts by Vice Chairman John D. Rockefeller IV to investigate the program, including by refusing in 2006 to provide requested documents to the full committee. The CIA restricted access to information about the program from members of the committee beyond the chairman and vice chairman until September 6, 2006, the day the president publicly acknowledged the program, by which time 117 of the 119 known detainees had already entered CIA custody. Until then, the CIA had declined to answer questions from other committee members that related to CIA interrogation activities. Prior to September 6, 2006, the CIA provided inaccurate information to the leadership of the committee. Briefings to the full committee beginning on September 6, 2006 also contained numerous inaccuracies, including inaccurate descriptions of how interrogation techniques were applied and what information was obtained from CIA detainees. The CIA misrepresented the views of members of Congress on a number of occasions. After multiple senators had been critical of the program and written letters expressing concerns to CIA Director Michael Hayden, Director Hayden nonetheless told a meeting of foreign ambassadors to the United States that every committee member was fully briefed and that this is not CIA's program. This is not the president's program. This is America's program. The CIA also provided inaccurate information describing the views of U.S. senators about the program to the Department of Justice. A year after being briefed on the program, the House and Senate Conference Committee considering the fiscal year 2008 Intelligence Authorization Bill voted to limit the CIA to using only interrogation techniques authorized by the Army Field Manual. That legislation was approved by the Senate and the House of Representatives in February 2008 and was vetoed by President Bush on March 8, 2008.
7. The CIA impeded effective White House oversight and decision-making. The CIA provided extensive amounts of inaccurate and incomplete information related to the operation and effectiveness of the CIA's detention and interrogation program to the White House, the National Security Council principals, and their staffs. This prevented an accurate and complete understanding of the program by executive branch officials, thereby impeding oversight and decision-making. According to CIA records, no CIA officer, up to and including CIA directors George Tenet and Porter Goss, briefed the president on the specific CIA enhancement interrogation techniques before April 2006. By that time, 38 of the 39 detainees identified as having been subjected to the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques had already been subjected to the techniques. The CIA did not inform the president or vice president of the location of CIA detention facilities other than country, redacted. At the direction of the White House, the Secretaries of State and Defense, both principals on the National Security Council, were not briefed on program specifics until September 2003. An internal CIA email from July 2003 noted that the White House is extremely concerned Secretary Powell would blow his stack if he were to be briefed on what's been going on. Deputy Secretary of State Armitage complained that he and Secretary Powell were cut out of the National Security Council coordination process. The CIA repeatedly provided incomplete and inaccurate information to the White House personnel regarding the operation and effectiveness of the CIA's detention and interrogation program. This includes the provision of inaccurate statements similar to those provided to other elements of the U.S. government and later to the public, as well as instances in which specific questions from White House officials were not answered truthfully or fully. In briefings for the National Security Council principals and White House officials, the CIA advocated for the continued use of the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques, warning that termination of this program will result in loss of life, possibly extensive.
8. The CIA's operation and management of the program complicated, and in some cases impeded, the national security missions of other executive branch agencies. The CIA, in the conduct of its detention and interrogation program, complicated and in some cases impeded the national security missions of other executive branch agencies, including the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, the State Department, and the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, ODNI. The CIA withheld or restricted information relevant to these agencies' missions and responsibilities, denied access to detainees, and provided inaccurate information on the CIA's detention and interrogation program to these agencies. The use of coercive interrogation techniques and covert detention facilities that did not meet traditional U.S. standards resulted in the FBI and the Department of Defense limiting their involvement in CIA interrogation and detention activities. This reduced the ability of the U.S. government to deploy available resources and expert personnel to interrogate detainees and operate detention facilities. The CIA denied specific requests from FBI Director Robert Mueller III for FBI access to CIA detainees that the FBI believed were necessary to understand CIA detainee reporting on threats to the U.S. homeland. Information obtained from CIA detainees was restricted within the intelligence community, leading to concerns among senior CIA officers that limitations on sharing information undermined government-wide counterterrorism analysis. The CIA blocked State Department leadership from access to information crucial to foreign policy decision-making and diplomatic activities. The CIA did not inform two secretaries of state of locations of CIA detention facilities, despite the significant foreign policy implications related to the hosting of clandestine CIA detention sites and the fact that the political leaders of host countries were generally informed of their existence. Moreover, CIA officers told U.S. ambassadors not to discuss the CIA program with State Department officials, preventing the ambassadors from seeking guidance on the policy implications of establishing CIA detention facilities in the countries in which they served. In two countries, U.S. ambassadors were informed of plans to establish a CIA detention site in the countries where they were serving after the CIA had already entered into agreements with the countries to host the detention sites. In two other countries where negotiations on hosting new CIA detention facilities were taking place, the CIA told local government officials not to inform the U.S. ambassadors. The ODNI was provided with inaccurate and incomplete information about the program, preventing the Director of National Intelligence from effectively carrying out the director's statutory responsibility to serve as the principal advisor to the President on intelligence matters. The inaccurate information provided to the ODNI by the CIA resulted in the ODNI releasing inaccurate information to the public in September 2006.
9. The CIA impeded oversight by the CIA's Office of Inspector General. The CIA avoided, resisted, and otherwise impeded oversight of the CIA's detention and interrogation program by the CIA's Office of Inspector General, OIG. The CIA did not brief the OIG on the program until after the death of a detainee, by which time the CIA had held at least 22 detainees at two different CIA detention sites. Once notified, the OIG reviewed the CIA's detention and interrogation program and issued several reports, including an important May 2004 special review of the program that identified significant concerns and deficiencies. During the OIG reviews, CIA personnel provided OIG with inaccurate information on the operation and management of the CIA's detention and interrogation program, as well as on the effectiveness of the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques. The inaccurate information was included in the final May 2004 special review, which was later declassified and released publicly and remains uncorrected. In 2005, CIA Director Goss requested in writing that the Inspector General not initiate further reviews of the CIA's detention and interrogation program until reviews already underway were completed. In 2007, Director Hayden ordered an unprecedented review of the OIG itself in response to the OIG's inquiries into the CIA's detention and interrogation program.
10. The CIA coordinated the release of classified information to the media, including inaccurate information concerning the effectiveness of the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques. The CIA's Office of Public Affairs and senior CIA officials coordinated to share classified information on the CIA's detention and interrogation program to select members of the media to counter public criticism, shape public opinion, and avoid potential congressional action to restrict the CIA's detention and interrogation authorities and budget. These disclosures occurred when the program was a classified covert action program and before the CIA had briefed the full committee membership on the program. The deputy director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center wrote to a colleague in 2005, shortly before being interviewed by a media outlet, that "we either get out and sell or we get hammered," which has implications beyond the media. Congress reads it, cuts our authorities, messes up our budget. We either put out our story or we get eaten. There is no middle ground. The same CIA officer explained to a colleague that when the Washington Post/New York Times quotes senior intelligence official, "it's us," authorized and directed by OPA, CIA's Office of Public Affairs. Much of the information the CIA provided to the media on the operation of the CIA's detention and interrogation program and the effectiveness of its enhanced interrogation techniques was inaccurate and was similar to the inaccurate information provided by the CIA to the Congress, the Department of Justice, and the White House.
11. The CIA was unprepared as it began operating its detention and interrogation program more than 6 months after being granted detention authorities. On September 17, 2001, the President signed a Covert Action Memorandum of Notification, MON, granting the CIA unprecedented counterterrorism authorities, including the authority to covertly capture and detain individuals posing a continuing serious threat of violence or death to U.S. persons and interests or planning terrorist activities. The MON made no reference to interrogations or coercive interrogation techniques. The CIA was not prepared to take custody of its first detainee. In the fall of 2001, the CIA explored the possibility of establishing clandestine detention facilities in several countries. The CIA's review identified risks associated with clandestine detention that led it to conclude that U.S. military bases were the best option for the CIA to detain individuals under the MON authorities. In late March 2002, the imminent capture of Abu Zubaydah prompted the CIA to again consider various detention options, in part to avoid declaring Abu Zubaydah to the International Committee of the Red Cross, which would be required if he were detained at a U.S. military base. The CIA decided to seek authorization to clandestinely detain Abu Zubaydah at a facility in country redacted, a country that had not previously been considered as a potential host for a CIA detention site. A senior CIA officer indicated that the CIA will have to acknowledge certain gaps in our planning preparations, but stated that this plan would be presented to the president. At a presidential daily briefing session that day, the president approved CIA's proposal to detain Abu Zubaydah in country redacted. The CIA lacked a plan for the eventual disposition of its detainees. After taking custody of Abu Zubaydah, CIA officers concluded that he should remain incommunicado for the remainder of his life, which may preclude Abu Zubaydah from being turned over to another country. The CIA did not review its past experience with coercive interrogations or its previous statement to Congress that inhumane physical or psychological techniques are counterproductive because they do not produce intelligence and will probably result in false answers. The CIA also did not contact other elements of the U.S. government with interrogation expertise. In July 2002, on the basis of consultations with contract psychologists and with very limited internal deliberation, the CIA requested approval from the Department of Justice to use a set of coercive interrogation techniques. The techniques were adapted from the training of U.S. military personnel at the U.S. Air Force Survival Evasion Resistance and Escape, SEER, school, which was designed to prepare U.S. military personnel for the conditions and treatment to which they might be subjected if taken prisoner by countries that do not adhere to the Geneva Conventions. As it began detention and interrogation operations, the CIA deployed personnel who lacked relevant training and experience. The CIA began interrogation training more than 7 months after taking custody of Abu Zubaydah, and more than 3 months after the CIA began using its enhanced interrogation techniques. CIA Director George Tenet issued formal guidelines for interrogations and conditions of confinement at detention sites in January 2003, by which time 40 of the 119 known detainees had been detained by the CIA.
12. The CIA's management and operation of its detention and interrogation program was deeply flawed throughout the program's duration, particularly so in 2002 and early 2003. The CIA's Cobalt detention facility in country, redacted, began operations in September 2002 and ultimately housed more than half of the 119 CIA detainees identified in this study. The CIA kept few formal records of the detainees in its custody at Cobalt. Untrained CIA officers at the facility conducted frequent, unauthorized, and unsupervised interrogations of detainees using harsh physical interrogation techniques that were not, and never became, part of the CIA's formal enhanced interrogation program. The CIA placed a junior officer with no relevant experience in charge of Cobalt. On November, redacted, 2002, a detainee who had been held partially nude and chained to a concrete floor died from suspected hypothermia at the facility. At the time, no single unit at CIA headquarters had clear responsibility for CIA detention and interrogation operations. In interviews conducted in 2003 with the Office of Inspector General, CIA's leadership and senior attorneys acknowledged that they had little or no awareness of operations at Cobalt, and some believe that enhanced interrogation techniques were not used there. Although CIA Director Tenet in January 2003 issued guidance for detention and interrogation activities, serious management problems persisted. For example, in December 2003, CIA personnel reported that they had made the unsettling discovery that the CIA had been holding a number of detainees about whom the CIA knew very little at multiple detention sites in country,